Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. And our show today is really something. Towards the back end of the show, we're going to be talking with Allison Ware. And she has an article out on Israeli video games in Gaza, exposing the war crimes committed with drones in recent attacks against Palestinians. And Allison is the president of the Council for National Interest and the executive director of the website If Americans Knew. So we'll be talking to her at the back end of the show. Opening up the show, we are going to be talking with Brandon L. Garrett, author of Convicting the Innocent, Where Criminal Prosecutions Go Wrong. And Brandon is a professor at the University of Virginia School of Law. On January 20th, 1984, Earl Washington, defended for all of 40 minutes by a lawyer who had never tried a death penalty case, was found guilty of rape and murder in the state of Virginia and sentenced to death. After 9 years on death row, DNA testing cast doubt on his conviction and saved his life. However, he spent another 8 years in prison before more sophisticated DNA technology proved his innocence and convicted the guilty man. DNA exonerations have shattered confidence in the criminal justice system by exposing how often we have convicted the innocent and the guilty walked free. Earl Washington was one of 250 exonerees in the next period of time that were basically their convictions were overturned and they got out of jail after spending an average of 13 years apiece in jail for something that they didn't do. And looking into this, Brandon Garrett decided to, he had to look at this. He had to analyze this. And he wrote a book called Convicting the Innocent, Where Criminal Prosecutions Go Wrong. And he dug into why this happens, how it happens, and what it reveals about the criminal justice system in this country. Brandon, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Well, great book, man. And I really highly recommend it. I think it's one of these books that's like a must read for people, especially in the climate we have in this country today.
Well, it's a depressing subject, but hopefully There's some rays of hope out there.
Yeah. Well, let's jump into it. The book is based, as I said, on the exonerations of 250 people whose convictions were overturned, or at least it was sparked off by that, whose convictions were overturned because of DNA testing revealing their innocence. But it's also much more than that. It tells it's much more than the story of the exonerees. What is that? What's the book?
What I did was I wanted to go back and read their trials. We've heard some of these stories of innocent people and the drama surrounding their release from prison. Every couple of weeks, someone is cleared by DNA testing. It's amazing. And, you know, the Innocence Project and other innocence projects around the country have been doing this work since the early 90s. What I wanted to do was read the original trials of these people to find out why they got convicted in the first place, to see whether there were any patterns, whether we could learn anything about what went wrong in these people's cases. And it's not easy to track down trial records. There was a lot of grunt work involved in that, and then once you get them, they're long, and there was a lot of work reading them. But these are vivid trials, they're dramatic trials, and they're amazing to look at in retrospect because you now know that a lot of the evidence at these trials was flawed.
Well, when you look at the 250 people, what did that say to you? I mean, here were people who, you know, they were people who actually were able to finally, because when they went on trial, when they were convicted, there wasn't DNA testing. But then they finally got access to DNA testing after fighting for that. Then they were proven to be innocent. But what does that say? What did that say to you about what did it reveal? I mean, you talk about it as the tip of the iceberg, and I thought that was a very important point to bring out to people.
Well, just for starters, before even talking about what their cases reveal about evidence at criminal trials, these 250 cases are just the ones that we know about. By definition, these are really serious cases because these were people who were in prison for so long that the technology changed while they were waiting. Right, and so all of their appeals failed, habeas failed, and then lo and behold, by the early 90s, you could do DNA testing. So most of these trials occurred in the 80s, and then they got out in the 90s or later, although some of them are more recent cases. But we just don't know how many other cases are out there because most criminal cases, you can't even do DNA testing now because there may be nothing at the crime scene that was left by the culprit. Most of these cases were rape cases where you can uniquely identify a stranger rapist if you can locate sperm in a rape kit taken from the victim. But say if there's a robbery and there's some hairs at the convenience store that was robbed, those could be from any number of customers. You don't know whether those hairs tell you anything about who the convenience store robber was. That's just an example. But the vast majority of crimes cannot have DNA testing done, do not have DNA testing done. And as a result, these DNA cases are special, they're unique. And unfortunately, what went wrong in these cases suggest that there may be a problem in many, many more cases than the ones that we know about.
I mean, I got the hit off of the beginnings of your book that you felt that, like, you know, look, the DNA testing was something that was, like you're saying, it was very special in this case when people were finally able to get it. But you have the vast majority of people aren't in jail because of rape and murder or things where there can be DNA. proof of their innocence or their guilt. There's a question here, though, that when you looked at that, and it really raises a big question of, was this occasional error? You know, what was it that if it wasn't, you know, if it wasn't like, you know, it wasn't occasional error, this point that you raise in the book in the beginning or begin to touch on is some kind of systemic error that's going on.
I think the number one thing that terrified me the most after having read these trials was that, you know, it would have made me feel better if these trials had been real miscarriages of justice, where these people were convicted based on weak evidence, or if these people were framed somehow. Because then we can think, okay, these were just bad trials, bad judges, jurors that were careless, and prosecutors that bent the rules. But when you look at these trials, there certainly was plenty of prosecutorial misconduct that came to light, yes. But the trial seemed strong at the time. The evidence seemed strong at the time. And that's terrifying, because before the DNA tests were done, everyone thought that these were solid convictions. Some of them really bulletproof. You had judges say there was overwhelming evidence of guilt. This guy confessed. This eyewitness was confident. The forensics were sound. And now we know that none of that was true. That's what makes these cases so troubling, because police used the same bad lineups in these cases that they still use to this day in most of the country. Police used the same interrogation techniques that they still use everywhere. Even though there's DNA, many of the traditional forensics that were used in these cases are just like the forensic techniques that are used most commonly in criminal cases where you can't do DNA. So not that much has changed. And that's why these cases are a real warning shot.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting, too, because one of the things that kept popping into my head, I mean, I also found it, you know, really terrifying in the sense of not just, you know, partly based on what you're saying, but also looking at this in the context of this whole phenomenon of mass incarceration that's going on today and the use of mass incarceration almost as a tool of social control, particularly for black people, but Latino people as well, and the creation of what Michelle Alexander has referred to as the new Jim Crow system, and that this kind of systemic thing that just rolls along and goes along without any, you know, real opposition and in fact there's opposition to trying to correct it. You know, I was thinking about this, the trials based on contestation are oftentimes talked about as the guarantee of finding truth in criminal cases in this country, and it's one of the pillars of the legal system. But here, the cases that you examined in this book kind of rip that to pieces, don't they?
Sure. You know, I mean, most cases, there's no trial, right? There's a guilty plea. But we tell ourselves that, look, those are people who bargain, but if someone really wants to push it to a trial, then they can get all the full-blown criminal procedure protections that our system offers. These were people who are innocent. That may have been part of the reason why they turned down guilty pleas. They wanted to prove it in court. And it turns out, right, that they could readily be convicted in court. Not only could they be convicted, but they can be convicted and kept in prison for years and years until they got DNA. Often prosecutors fought DNA testing, saying, look, this guy is clearly guilty. There is no point to doing a DNA test. But we don't even believe the DNA test results. We still think this guy is guilty. That's how reluctant our system was to overturn these verdicts.
Let me remind listeners, you're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. And I'm talking today with Brandon L. Garrett, the author of Convicting the Innocent, Where Criminal Prosecutions Go Wrong. Now, Brandon, one of the things is, you know, doing some articles and coverage of the hunger strike in the California state prisons out here in the SHU units. And, you know, you talk to a lot of people, and a lot of times people had this assumption that if you're in jail, you must have done something to be there. You know, I mean, and that was a very widespread thing. And especially I kept thinking about this, and because you raised this in your book, there's a certain assumption, I think, that gets propagated in society that if you end up in court, really, if you get that far to the point where you're actually in court, there's all this evidence that's piled up against you, there's all this stuff that's going on, that you must have done something. And you dig into some things, some of the things that actually are the bulwarks of that kind of thinking, including the idea. And then you tear them apart, which I think is important. I want to walk through some of these. One of them is the confession, you know, the whole idea that, well, look, he said he did it. What do you want? Nobody was you know, pushing him into this. He actually said he did it. He confessed. And even if he was pushed in, he knew all the details of the crime. And that, I think, is something that people really kind of get misled by.
Sure. You know, a lot of cases get resolved by confessions. A lot of juveniles will pretty readily confess, you know, even in just 20 minutes, half an hour. Vulnerable people will confess more quickly than others. But I think, you know, courts, regular people in our own lives, we know we wouldn't confess to something really serious that we didn't do, would we? You know, maybe we tell white lies here and there, or maybe we don't remember something, and so we say we left the keys in the car when we really didn't. But to confess to something really serious that'll change your life, that could throw you in jail for life, you know, who would do that? But even more important, you know, police know that sometimes people falsely confess. All the people came forward seeking attention, confessing to the kidnapping of the Lindbergh baby, or people might seek attention, or they might be mentally ill. And so police know that they're supposed to test a confession. It's not enough for someone to just say, I did it. They need to be able to say what they did. And in these cases, in the cases I looked at, there were 40 people who falsely confessed among the group of innocent guys that I was studying. And in the second chapter of the book, I look at those false confessions, and it turns out all but two of them said a lot more than I did it. They described what they did, and they gave details. And so police came into the courtroom at trial and said, look, this guy didn't just say I did it. He used details that had inside information that only the killer would have known. We don't make those public when we investigate a case. Those are blacked out from the public so that we don't contaminate our investigation. And this person said, I used this kind of knife, and I stabbed the victim 33 times, and the victim's house looked like this, and there was a beige couch, and this is what the victim, this is what he was wearing. And so that made these confessions look really, really powerful. And the jury heard, you know, they didn't hear about a weak case. They heard about an incredibly strong case. They must have felt perfectly great about convicting this terrible murderer who confessed in detail. You know, I think we could all imagine that we would want to convict someone like that who did a terrible crime and admitted to it with all of these telling details.
But now, isn't there something, I mean, even in just sort of digging in to try and seek the truth in all this, actually, one question I have for you is, are there more cases that go to actual trial than are settled? Or is it the opposite?
No, the vast majority of cases are settled. The vast majority of people plead guilty.
So in a sense, that's actually a standard form of, you know, or a not so standard form of a confession. You're pleading guilty.
Yep.
You're saying, you know, and I kept thinking that people have a certain sense of, you know, look, sometimes and I talked to many people who said, look, I didn't do it, but you know what? I'm facing 20 to life versus 5.
Certainly the death penalty. Some of these innocent guys pled guilty. Because otherwise they might be executed, and especially actually among the people who confessed during interrogations, they said, "Look, I didn't really give those details to the police. They told me the details. They contaminated the confession. They told me what to say, but they're going to deny it at trial, and with that confession, I'm cooked." And so some of these people, you know, pleaded guilty. Some of them even falsely accused other innocent people, figuring that was the only way they can avoid the death penalty. And so you have these multipliers where one person falsely confesses. They're told all the details of the crime, which is something police are not supposed to do, but they did in some of these cases. And then they brought in other innocent people, and you had whole groups of innocent people rounded up based on one false confession after another.
Well, it says something about how people rightfully, I think, perceive the justice system in the sense of it does become let's make a deal and recognizing that. And you know, it's interesting because in a lot of very poor neighborhoods, especially a lot of black neighborhoods and neighborhoods of oppressed nationality people, the idea that, you know, going to jail is oftentimes these days seen as this is just something that happens. You know, it's sort of in your future. And in fact, even their pundits, some of their wisest pundits get out there in the newspapers and say that crime is a rational career for a lot of children in these ghetto areas. And so you have this whole sort of culture that's built up around this idea of you're just going to it's a quick train. It's a long train, a quick train, a steady train, and always there. You might get off at one stop. It's prison. You get out of prison. You come back. You may end up going around. That's just the way life is. It seems to me that there's a whole comment on the nature of the legal system here.
What's even worse is, right, these cases involving confessions and eyewitnesses and forensics, these are really serious felony rapes and murders. These are not revolving door type crimes where people were expecting to serve a couple of years. Mm-hmm. These are the cases that supposedly our system is the most careful about, where more people do go to trial because the sentences are so big. And even in the most serious cases, you had evidence that was treated really casually. You know, if we really cared about getting confessions right, we should be videotaping the entire interrogation so we know who said what. So we know if someone really did tell the police inside information about the crime or whether the police really fed them the information. It's not expensive to videotape an interrogation, but most departments don't do it yet.
We're talking with Brandon L. Garrett, the author of Convicting the Innocent, Where Criminal Prosecutions Go Wrong. Now, Brandon, one of the things that really sort of slapped me in the head, not because I thought, oh, well, you know, this is, I'm not naive about what goes on, but this point about misidentification, and it in your book, you talk about that being the leading cause of wrongful convictions. And this is clearly something that very few people understand in terms of its frequency and its impact. Can we talk about that a little?
There's big news in that area this week. The New Jersey Supreme Court just decided a really, really remarkable decision, and I was really honored that they cited to my book in the decision, which provides an entirely new structure for handling eyewitness identifications in the courtroom. So it's really exciting news. Hopefully other courts will start to look to New Jersey as a model. But I think we all know that eyewitnesses can make mistakes. We have a hard time remembering faces. I think it's hard for us to remember, you know, what did we wear yesterday or last Tuesday? It's hard to remember these things. And that's why police use lineups to test memory. But what people haven't understood, and jurors certainly can't be expected to understand, is that every time you remember something you saw, your memory is affected. There's not just a picture in our mind of a face we saw. When police give us a lineup to test our memory, that actually can change our memory. And that's what psychologists have found over the last 30 years. And so what really bothered me about these innocent people's cases is that you had these eyewitnesses coming into the courtroom and saying they were 100% sure that this was the guy. This is the person they saw. Absolute confidence. But they were wrong. And how could that be?
Well, how could it be? I mean, here's the thing. Here's the thing. It's, like, interesting because, you know, you did a, which we're going to listen to later, but you did a video or helped do a video for the Innocence Project around the having one of these women who was 100% certain that the man that she saw in the courtroom was the man that raped her. Turns out, you know.
So her story is an amazing one, and it's a perfect example of what happened across all of these trials. There's a website called Getting It Right, which is a multimedia resource about my book, and it's hosted on the Innocence Project, a website, innocenceproject.org. And one of the most interesting videos in that whole resource, if you click on eyewitnesses, there's a video by Jennifer Thompson, who was the victim of a terrible rape in North Carolina. And she was sure at trial that Ronald Cotton was the man who assaulted her. And in fact, on appeal, he ran into a guy in prison named Bobby Poole, who he thought looked like the original composite that she had drawn. And he thought that that's the guy who did it. They brought him in at a hearing, and she says, "I've never seen Bobby Poole. I've never seen that guy in my life." Well, DNA testing done 10 years later showed that Ronald Cotton was absolutely innocent and Bobby Poole was absolutely guilty. And Jennifer Thompson has been brave enough to speak about this. And she says, you know, Ronald Cotton's face is in my mind now, and I know he didn't do it. They wrote a book together, Jennifer Thompson and Ronald Cotton. And what she has described is how the police used lineups that ended up encouraging her each step of the way. And the police didn't realize it. They changed their policies and adopted double-blind procedures, all the best lineup procedures in response to this case. So they really learned something from what went wrong. But she said, you know, when I first picked Ronald Cotton out, I said, "I'm really unsure." And they said, "Well, we need you to be sure." That kind of had the effect of making her want to be sure. And she said, "Well, let me see it again." And they showed her a live lineup. And she said, "Well, I'm still not sure. I'm deciding between these two people." They said, "Again, we need you to be sure. Try." And so she said, "Okay, it's Ronald Cotton." And they said, "Good work. Good job." And they encouraged her. And she said she felt this wave of relief wash over her when they said that. And then by the time of trial, she wasn't unsure anymore. She was absolutely sure. And that was true across all of these exonerees trials. The victim, the eyewitness at trial, absolutely sure. But they actually remembered, and I was surprised they remembered. They described how when they first saw the lineup, they first saw the photo array, they weren't sure at all. The police gave them encouragement, or they felt better because the suspect was the only one wearing it, clothes just like the attacker wore. Sometimes it was the only color photo, so they fixated on it. And so these bad lineups really, really changed these people's memories so that they ended up picking the wrong guy. And often they said, "Yeah, you know, when I originally described the person who attacked me, it was someone who had a mustache, who was taller, but now I'm sure it's this guy." They really originally had a memory that was different. Mm-hmm. And maybe if police had handled the lineups better, they would have been led to the right person.
You know, it's interesting because that's the point that you make in your book about certainty is very subjective and very malleable, you know, which has a lot to do, you know, because I was astounded when you had some of these people where you said you actually, walked through a couple of these cases where these women would say, you know, "Well, at first, like you're saying, I wasn't certain, I wasn't sure, I wasn't clear, even didn't recognize the person that was accused of raping them as they were standing in the lobby of the courthouse." And then when they went in, suddenly said, "Yes, I'm certain, absolutely certain that that's the man that raped me."
These bad lineups, police are not doing right by these victims when they use bad lineups, because these victims had a memory of the person who attacked them. And, we want members of the public, right, who see crimes, we want them to come forward and report it. We want them to want to cooperate with the police. And yet, all across the country, most police departments typically had no rules, no procedures in writing at all about how to do a lineup right. And it turns out it's a really delicate affair. You have to do it right because you can change someone's memory. More police departments now are adopting double-blind lineups where the person running the lineup just doesn't know who the suspect is. So there's no way they can give cues, even inadvertently. But a lot of departments still don't do it. And the New Jersey decision was so important this week. In New Jersey, they've already done double-blind lineups for some time now. But what the court said is that we have to make sure it's done right. In every case where there's a question about the lineup procedures, we need to have a hearing to go over everything that happened and make sure this is reliable. And if something happened wrong, if a double-blind lineup wasn't used right, we need to carefully instruct the jury so that they really understand how eyewitness memory works, because a jury otherwise might think that a confident eyewitness is a trustworthy one, and that's just not true.
You know, and it's interesting. This is in relation to the next question, which comes off of that because, you know, still, I really have to keep coming back to, we live in a society today where the prison population is gigantic. I mean, 2 million, around 2 million, and it's constantly growing, and it's the vast majority are Black and Latino. And you look at this, it's really, you know, part of this whole misidentification, this eyewitness identification that turns out that they're not really identifying the person that attacked them or whatever, you know, is tied up with what you talk about as the cross-racial identification. This is a very big problem, but it rarely figures in any courtroom.
No, that's right. You know, actually, that's the New Jersey story. The reason why the New Jersey Supreme Court first started to get involved in this is that there was a case of a man named McKinley Cromedy. He's a Black man identified by a white victim. And there has been social science research going back a couple decades now that people just have a harder time recognizing faces of another race. And it's not just race, actually. People have a hard time recognizing faces of another age, too. But in that case, the police used a bad lineup. They did a show-up where they just showed her comedy and said it is the guy. So that's inherently suggestive. And his lawyer argued, look, my client's innocent. This eyewitness got it wrong. We know she's trying to do the right thing, but she got it wrong here. And we should be able to tell the jury that, look, the fact that this was a cross-race identification may have played a role. And the New Jersey Supreme Court reversed and said, yes, he should have been allowed to instruct the jury on that. Jurors don't know about that. You know, we wouldn't expect jurors to know the social science research on cross-racial effects. That's kind of a technical subject. And then after they reversed it, DNA showed that Cromedy was innocent.
I mean, doesn't this tie into, too, though, if you look at the social science of it, in a sense of, look, I mean, we're fed from the moment we're born. If you're white, you're fed the idea that Black people and Black men in particular are, you know, savage and waiting to just jump on white women and rob your house, kill your family, all this kind of stuff. Don't walk through such and such street in such and such neighborhood if you're a woman, and I don't care what time of day it is, and actually nobody white should walk through that neighborhood because they'll get you. You know, and there's this whole demonization of Black people in general that I think really feeds into the subjective view of people in terms of this cross-racial misidentification, don't you think?
Well, there's something even, you know, more problematic that's going on in my book, and I don't have the answer. Maybe some of your listeners do. You know, we know that Blacks and minorities are overrepresented in our criminal justice system, right, at every stage, right? Black and minority men typically are, you know, overrepresented among people arrested and then prosecuted and then convicted. But among these innocent people that I looked at, the first 250 cases that have come to light through DNA, many more Blacks and minorities are in that group than even among the people serving sentences generally. So, you know, there are too many Blacks and minorities compared to, you know, even underlying crime rates who are serving in prison for rape and murder. But there are even more disproportionate numbers of minorities in these exoneration cases than in the general prison population, which is already, you know, racially skewed. And so what's going on? Why were so many Blacks and minorities among these innocent people? One possibility is that so many of them were misidentified in these cross-racial identifications. So about half of the eyewitness identifications that I looked at involved cross-race. And most of those were a white victim and a Black, typically male, sometimes Latino, suspect who was picked out. And so something about the racial politics in rape cases where you have victims and cross-race encounters may have played a role. It may be that prosecutors really push for the big sentences in cases where there's a white victim and a Black defendant. They figure jurors will take those cases real seriously and throw the book at those defendants. Maybe it's the case that Blacks and minorities get those long sentences, and so that's why they were in a group that DNA proved innocent years and years later. You know, I don't know. But it's a real, real disturbing racial disparity.
You know, Brandon, there's another thing that comes up which I really want to, I don't want to miss the opportunity to talk about this because it completely smashed all of my delusions from watching Quincy and all these TV shows and movies and, you know, detective novels and all this stuff. And that is forensic science. You actually make a point that this is really whacked out, that most of the tests involved in forensic science are notoriously unreliable or subject to extremely subjective interpretation. Can we talk about some of that?
You know, it gives and it takes. There's this great quote by exoneree Roy Brown that I include in my book where he says, you know, real science set me free, but junk science sent me to prison. And so, right, these stories are in some ways a triumph of science, right? DNA is invented not to help in criminal cases, right? It's geneticists that figured out how to replicate DNA and do these different DNA testing techniques to isolate parts of the double helix and to identify people using it. And then all of a sudden it has this powerful use in criminal cases. That's amazing, right? That's part of what makes these exonerations so exciting, is the cutting-edge science that's used to show how our criminal justice system got it wrong. But most cases don't use DNA even today. And instead they use the same kind of comparison techniques that we've been using for a long time, like fingerprint comparison, where you just sort of look at fingerprints in detail under a microscope, or hair comparison, same thing. You look at hairs in detail under a microscope, and the examiner looks at them back and forth and decides whether they're similar or not. It's very subjective. A lot of what forensics is comparing stuff under a microscope. It's not fancy technology, it's just a microscope. And a lot of those techniques were used in these innocent guys' trials. And these were cases where there was forensic evidence. Later they could use DNA, but at the time they looked at fingerprints. Even more, they looked at blood types, they looked at hairs, they looked at fibers, sometimes bite marks. And you had these forensic analysts coming into the courtroom saying, I'm absolutely sure it shows it's the guy, it's a match. And we now know that they were wrong. And even worse, when I went back and looked at the trials, these analysts were exaggerating. They would claim that only 1 in 5,000 people could have a hair like this, or this is an unusual hair that could only have come from someone like the defendant. Or they would use the wrong statistics for blood typing, which is pretty straightforward. They just have to use the right statistics. They would get them wrong. And so it was just really shocking to see these forensic analysts exaggerate on the stand right and left. And in most of these cases, they did it. And the defense lawyers often didn't catch on. The courts didn't do anything about it. It made you wonder how these analysts testify in all the other cases.
You know, one question I had, which I've had this question ever since, an episode of The Sopranos where Paulie was sitting around and he was talking about, he's talking to his friends and he's saying, oh, yeah, we got some trouble here. And they're saying, yeah, they're going to arrest us all. They arrested so-and-so. And they got a lot of evidence. He says, what do they got? And the guy says, fingerprints. Says, hey, what do they got? Fingerprints. They got nothing. You know, he says, look, no two fingerprints match. Oh, yeah, there's 6 billion people on the face of the earth. You know how many they would have to measure, look at all of them, and then look at everybody in history to say that no two fingerprints match. And I thought of that as I read your book on this. And it's, you know, there is this point that actually what real science can tell you is important. And what sham science does is it really can destroy, you know, the whole fabric of society in a certain sense. I mean, it's, you know, the idea that people have grown up thinking that, well, we can look at two hairs and definitively say this comes from that person, or we can look at bite marks. I mean, I was really, you know, amazed by the point about bite marks and voice comparison. You know, I always thought you could match sound waves that if you record things and you could match up who's saying what. And it turns out that all that is, in fact, sham science. So you have a combination of the sham science, and then you have the bad analysis, the very bad and subjective interpretation of that mock science. It's really it's a hellified contradiction there, you know?
Well, some of this, you know, what you call sham science, it's used in our courtrooms every day in thousands of cases. Especially, you know, fingerprints are used all the time. And I think most people, you know, maybe they're not as sophisticated about criminal justice as Polly Walnuts, right? they think that fingerprints are individual and that they're unique. And if someone's fingerprint matches, that's it. You know, early on they called it DNA fingerprinting.
Huh.
Because people thought, oh, if you call it fingerprinting, that means it's really sophisticated. And now we know that fingerprinting pales in comparison to DNA. With DNA, we actually have databases. We can say something about what percentage of the population has a particular DNA type. With fingerprints, those studies still have yet to be done. And so it's an assumption that fingerprints are unique. And we have no idea how much, you know, most fingerprints, there's a lot of information if you have a pristine print like you do if you apply for a job and you roll your fingers in the ink. But the crime scene fingerprints that police are usually working with are kind of smudged, partial prints. They're messy. And a big question in any case is, you know, what's the information that's even there? You know, how much can you get from this fingerprint? You know, they're big fingerprint databases, the CODIS database that the FBI runs. But when they run a partial print from a crime scene through that database, they often get tons of prints that sort of look alike, and then the examiner has to go through all of them. You know, things really did change in 2009. Because the scientific community came together, and the National Academies of Sciences did a big report on all of the forensics, all of the non-DNA forensics. And they basically said that they are all flawed, none of them. No forensic technique aside from DNA can accurately and consistently link evidence to a particular person. None of them can do it. Some of them may claim to do it, and that's wrong. And more research needs to be done in all of these areas, where you have different techniques used by different labs, you have confusing language that these analysts use, and where we still don't know just how reliable the techniques are. But in response to that report, courts haven't done much. More research is being done now, and there's more money for research. Fingerprint studies may finally be done. But it's all happening slowly, and in the meantime, courts are letting it all in still.
Well, let's talk about, we're going to have to move on a little bit quicker, but I think in relation to this, because I have a couple more questions, and one is, it's related to this. Why so little court review? You know, it's an interesting point you make in the beginning of your book that most constitutional rights, talking about why the courts are reluctant, the judges are reluctant to actually review a lot of these cases, and you make the point that most constitutional rights relate to procedure, not accuracy in this country. And it's sort of captured in this comment by some high official, I remember, it was during the Bush years, where he said, what are you worried, the execution of an innocent person? We're not going to stop that. Maybe the Supreme Court that said this, that arguments about his innocence matter little so long as the procedures were all followed correctly. You know, it seems like there's a lot of that tied up, and there's a lot at stake for the legal system in sort of perpetuating that kind of view, it seems.
Well, you know, I talk about this in the book. You know, a lot of people assume that there is some constitutional claim you can bring if you're actually innocent to get out of jail. Right? There should be a right to be free if you're innocent, if you can really show it. Maybe lots of people claim their innocence and they're not, you know, they're making it up. But if you really have powerful evidence of your innocence, that should violate due process or something, right? Mm-hmm. But there actually is no such claim. What the Supreme Court has said, and they've stuck to it over the years, is that, you know, the trial is the opportunity to argue your guilt or innocence. And once the jury has convicted you, you know, that's final. And we're not going to reverse that unless there's a constitutional violation. And by the way, we're just not going to decide whether innocence is a constitutional violation. We've never seen a case like that before.
Yeah, right.
Of course, now we have seen those cases time and time again. We know actually innocent people are convicted. And, you know, one response to these cases has been that the states have created new rules to allow people to get DNA after they are convicted. And they have writs of innocence, providing new rights to assert innocence in the state courts. There's still nothing in the U.S. Constitution, still nothing you can do in federal court if you're convicted in the states. And a lot of these state statutes are really vague, and courts have interpreted them really narrowly, making it still pretty hard in some places to get DNA. Or to get relief if DNA proves that you're innocent. Mm. So it's a real uphill battle to argue innocence. Everyone says, look, the trial was your chance. We don't care that new technology came about after trial. We don't care that, you know, the informants have all recanted, and it sounds like, you know, maybe there's some problem with your confession. You had your chance to prove that at trial. And there's a real reluctance to overturn convictions.
Mm-hmm. One last question, Brandon, and then I want to go into listening to, and we'll let you go, and I want to go into listening to, then I'm going to play for the listeners that little clip from, Jennifer Thompson?
Yes.
I want to play that little clip. Amazing. Yeah. I want people to hear that. It's very moving. But one quick question. What's the most important lesson you draw from these exonerations and what you learned in the course of investigating this and writing your book?
I think the most important message is optimistic, that there are real problems with our criminal procedure. But a lot of the solutions just aren't that hard, and we should be taking them seriously. We can do double-blind lineups. It doesn't cost anything to have a different officer in the room. We can record interrogations. We can insist that forensics be presented accurately. That's not hard to do. And once the evidence gets contaminated early on, it's just really, really hard for our system to sort it out. It may be too late by the time that false confession is taken or the eyewitness says, you know, he's confident.
Your Lady Macbeth quote fits well, right? Your Lady Macbeth quote fits well. You can't, it's very difficult to undo what's done.
These people were lucky. They could undo it with DNA. Mm-hmm. But for the vast majority of criminal cases, the most important thing is to get the evidence right early on.
All right, Brandon, thank you very much for joining us. And the book is Convicting the Innocent, Where Criminal Prosecutions Go Wrong by Brandon L. Garrett. And it's from Harvard University Press. I really highly recommend reading this book. It's really an eye-opener. Brandon, thank you again.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Sure, take care now. All right, we're going to listen to a short clip, about 5 minutes, from a woman, Jennifer Thompson, who went into court 100% convinced that she had identified the man who raped her. This is an extremely important clip to listen to, so I wanted people to get a chance to hear it.
It was early in the morning. I felt something in my room, something brushed my arm. And when I looked over the side of the bed, I noticed it was a person's head. And that's when I said, "Who is that? Who's there?" And he immediately sprang up on the bed and straddled my body and put a knife to my throat and told me to shut up or he was going to kill me. Over the next 20 minutes during the assault, as he raped me, I made two decisions. One is, if there was a way I could live, I would figure it out. And if I lived, I wanted to memorize everything about this person. So I began to pay really close attention to details about his face and his eyes and his voice and his hair and how much he weighed, the clothing he was wearing.
I was convinced that Jennifer would be able to recognize her assailant. She was able to provide a detailed description not only in terms of his physical appearance, but also what he wore at the time of the assault. It was clear to me that she had an ample opportunity to see him. Coupled with her determination and presence of mind, I was convinced without a doubt that she could identify her assailant.
More than 250 convicted prisoners have been exonerated on the basis of DNA testing in the U.S. alone. Eyewitness misidentification played a role in more than 75% of those cases, making it the leading contributing factor to wrongful conviction. But unfortunately, witnesses are often wrong. How can this happen, and is it possible for us to prevent these eyewitness identification errors from happening?
We received an anonymous tip that Ronald Cotton not only fit the composite in terms of appearance, but the general description of the assailant. We had his photo on file, and we felt like he could be a good suspect in this particular case and thought that we should do a photographic lineup.
Within 2 days, I was asked to come down and look at a photo array. The officer said, we're going to show you 6 photographs. Don't feel compelled to choose anyone. The suspect may or may not be in there. When you're in a police department and there's a photo lineup, there's this sense that one of these has got to be their suspect, and it's my job to find him. I began to narrow it down. I could very quickly discount 4 of them, narrowing it down to 2 photographs.
According to the records, Jennifer examined the 2 photographs for 4 to 5 minutes. Research shows that memory is highly malleable and that an eyewitness who is uncertain can become much more certain over time.
I noticed that she did focus on photograph number 4 for a bit, then moved over to Ronald Cotton's photograph, which I think was number 6, before picking it up and saying that this was the man who raped me.
And I wanted to be very confident and very sure, so I took my time. And that's when I held up the picture of Ronald Cotton and said, this is the man who did this. They said, are you sure? And I said, I'm positive. And they looked at me and said, we thought that was the guy.
Since the officers present knew that Ronald Cotton was the suspect in this case, it's possible that they unconsciously provided information to Jennifer Thompson. And we do know that Jennifer Thompson's confidence was influenced by the positive feedback that she did receive after making her identification. In laboratory studies, researchers compare groups of participants who receive feedback to individuals who did not receive that kind of information in a control group. And what we know is that people who receive feedback, their confidence skyrockets, just like it did for Jennifer Thompson after her identification in this case.
And there was this huge relief that washed over me because I had gotten it right.
On August 8th, 11 days after the assault, Jennifer Thompson was brought in to view a physical lineup consisting of 7 men. Ronald Cotton was the only lineup participant whose picture had been present in the photo array that Jennifer Thompson saw. And repeating only one individual in multiple procedures increases witness confidence even when that witness is wrong.
And as we walked out of the room, I remember looking at the officer saying, how did I do? Did I do okay? And one of the officers said, you did great. That was the guy you picked out in the photo lineup.
By the time she testified in court and identified Ronald Cotton as her assailant, she was 100% certain. Ronald Cotton's conviction was based primarily on the eyewitness identification evidence of Jennifer Thompson. But we know that Ronald Cotton was completely innocent of this crime. He was exonerated based on DNA evidence in June 1995. At the same time, it was learned that another man who was in prison for very similar crime was actually the person who raped Jennifer Thompson.
I can remember thinking to myself, if that's wrong, if Bobby Poole raped me and it wasn't Ronald Cotton, then maybe everything I thought was true is not true.
All right, now that brings me to something that I often say during this show or at the end of this show, and that is, you know, listen, there's no reason that we have to live like this. There's absolutely no reason that human beings have to live like this, that this kind of legal system that exists for the oppression and the social control of whole groups of people is allowed to stand like this, there's no reason that we need to live in a society that is based on and rooted in the fundamental oppression of millions and millions of people and having their legal system that doesn't exist to protect the rights of the people and the rights of the people to live in a society free of all this, but instead exists as a tool of repression and oppression. So I want to read something to you from the Constitution for the New Socialist Republic in North America draft proposal, and that's from the Revolutionary Communist Party, USA. And it goes something like this. And this is taken from the section of the Constitution entitled Legal and Civil Rights and Liberties. Trials involving prosecution for criminal offenses shall be presided over by a judge who shall have been appointed to that position in accordance with Article 1, Section 3 and other relevant parts of this Constitution. The basic rules and procedures for criminal and any other legal proceedings shall be established by the appropriate legislative body. These rules and procedures must include the right of defendants to the presumption of innocence. That is, they may be convicted of a crime only if it is proven beyond a reasonable doubt that they are guilty of that crime, and juries shall be duly informed and reminded of this principle. The right of persons against self-incrimination, including the right not to testify in proceedings in which they are accused of violation of the law, and the right of defendants to have presented in open court all witnesses and evidence against them, and the right, exercised directly by themselves and or through the representation of legal counsel, to question and challenge all such witnesses and evidence. In keeping with the basic orientation articulated in Article 1, Section 3, regarding the use of and translation into different languages in judicial proceedings, all defendants in criminal proceedings have the right to any assistance they may require from translators in order to fully understand and participate in these legal proceedings, and to fully exercise their rights in such proceedings. In criminal proceedings, the accused has the right to have a trial by a jury selected from the general adult population of voting age in the relevant jurisdiction, in accordance with laws and procedures established in conformity with this Constitution. A defendant in a criminal case may also choose to forego a jury trial and to have the verdict rendered by a judge. The law and due process of law shall provide for appeal in the cases of criminal conviction. With regard to the appeal process, the more serious the crime, the more that weight shall be given to providing avenues of appeal. Legal representation by the Department of Legal Defense and Assistance shall be provided if requested by the defendants or if ordered by a judge with the relevant authority in appeals of criminal convictions, without unacceptable risk and danger to society and the people, and where doing so would not be contrary to what is set forth in the Constitution. Again, that's from the Constitution for the New Socialist Republic in North America draft proposal. And again, we don't have to live this way. The only reason we continue to live like this is because we continue to live under this system. There's a whole other way of life that we should be and could be living, but that's going to take fundamental revolutionary change. We got to build up a whole new world. We're going to take a quick musical break, and when we come back, we'll be talking with Allison Ware about the use of drones against the Palestinian people in Gaza. So stay tuned. Everlast with Stone in My Hand, all right? Really great song. Someday I'll play the whole thing, but not today because I'm really anxious to talk to my next guest. My next guest is Allison Ware. And Allison, I ran across Allison's work. I found an article she had just recently written, which was called Israeli Video Games in Gaza. And Allison's the president of the Council for the National Interest and executive director of If Americans Knew. I was intrigued by the title of If Americans Knew and horrified by the content of her article, Israeli Video Games in Gaza. Allison, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Sure. Well, let's jump into this. You show You show a picture of a young child, a Palestinian child in Gaza, and you talk about how this child, as you, and you're looking at it, and everybody who's ever had a kid or been around children looks at exactly that happy face, the kind of running, this little ball of energy. The next picture that's in your article is of him with his guts hanging out, and you talk about how he was the victim of, he was murdered by a missile fired by a drone that was operating in Gaza. Can you talk about the use of drones in Gaza? What the hell's going on there?
I'd be glad to. I mean, it's such a sad topic, but it's so important to know it. And of course, U.S. forces are using drones in Afghanistan and in Pakistan. But what's going on in Gaza is these drones, these are unmanned aircraft, they're called, that are sent over Gaza that fire lethal missiles at people, at groups, at locations that are supposedly these types of surgical strikes that we keep hearing about that are not so surgical. The subtitle of my article is Minimal Collateral Damage. And in this case, the minimal collateral damage were two-year-old boys. That's pretty minimal, living only 2 years of life. So these drones are operated by people sitting very comfortably inside Israel. They are usually women, it happens, as you know, so they're not taking away combat troops. They are women operating these drones that give them real-time video feeds. They're very high-tech. They're able to see what they're about to shoot and then kill individuals in Gaza. Quite often, they kill more than the target. And let's remember the target. This is a non-judicial assassination. This is murder. There's been no legal process involved. But they keep murdering people using these high-tech drones. And the result is the same. You know, it's still somebody has been killed, blown to pieces in a very, very gruesome fashion. And, you know, in some senses, why does it matter what it is, a drone or not? But I think there's just something especially chilling about the use of modern mechanisms to kill people.
Well, when you're talking also about, look, you know, there's this disparity here. You know, you're talking about a people who, you know, have been the most been accused of, you know, well, there's suicide bombs and the most have been accused of firing rusty old rockets that are, you know, like from the Flintstones era. At the same time, then they're going up against this whole horrific, absolutely at the top of the chain, Israeli war machine, and drones being one of the most horrific examples of that. I mean, the idea that, you know, you said these women go to, it's like sort of like those cats that are today's combat pilots going to work in McLean, Virginia in their jumpsuits, you know, getting out of their Mazdas and their BMWs and going, jumping into work in their flight suits and then sitting behind a video game and bombing the hell out of whether it's Pakistan, Afghanistan, wherever, you know, Libya, you know, they were using drones in Libya, and it's all this stuff that happens. It's sort of, to me, that's part of the horrifying and the very chilling nature of this thing. And this is not a new thing for the Zionist government to do in relation to the region there, and especially in relation to Gaza, is it?
No, it's not. And as you say, just to emphasize, the Israeli military is usually rated as the fourth or fifth most powerful military on the planet. And Gaza has, as I have been there, it has virtually no military. It has these small resistance groups that try to fight back, that have, you know, they have homemade rockets, and now they have some that are a little bit more advanced, but you know, the one-sided nature of this so-called conflict is just gargantuan. Israel's in the forefront of drone use. There are a number of articles that tell about their use and basically describe how wonderful these weapons are. And they describe them being used in many cases in Lebanon, which was also very one-sided, the most recent Lebanon war, as they call it. But what kind of war has over 1,000 people killed on one side, and in Gaza, something like 9 on the other side? So they were used in the Gaza massacre. Where it was 1,400 Gazans killed, very large number, completely civilians, women and children, and 9 Israelis. In Lebanon war, they were used there. The numbers that I was able to research quickly, the numbers vary, but it was at least close to 18,000 Lebanese. That's very conservative, I think it was. There are a number of reports far higher, but I used the conservative number. So there were at least 18,000 Lebanese killed by these high-tech Israeli forces using drones compared to 344 Israelis. They have used the drones repeatedly in many of their assaults on people in the Middle East. And again, we don't really hear about this. We don't see what it looks like. We don't understand what it's about because In most cases, the U.S. media are not even reporting this. These two-year-olds were barely, in most U.S. news reports, they weren't even mentioned. If they were mentioned at all, it was way down in the story, and of course, there's no personal kind of information given about them.
Right, and yet the kids that are killed in Israel are raised to the consciousness of the world. You know, and I want to remind listeners, you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking now with Allison Ware, who's the executive director of the website If Americans Knew. Now, Allison, one of the things that when I was reading your article and some of the background material you provided in that article and on your website, which I really want to encourage people to go to, it's a really, really good website full of information that you don't get anywhere else. It's If Americans Knew. One of the things that I was really drawn to, though, too, was that you actually reveal that there's, during the war on Gaza in 2009, there was the whole thing was going on that where they were actually testing out the operation
Cast Lead.
Yeah, that in that operation that they were actually testing out a brand new drone that is actually stands to, I think, revolutionize, in a certain sense, revolutionize or radically change, you know, Israel's abilities in that region of the world in terms of drones. And that was the Heron T. Is that it?
That's right. That's right. They keep, you know, making these even more lethal, even more cruel, I guess, in the results. So that's right. And in fact, just recently, while these assaults were going on, this article is talking about one of them. Right during that time, they unveiled in Washington, D.C., at sort of a trade show, their latest high-tech drone called the Ghost. The company announced with pride, quote, is at the forefront of technology thanks to years of experience and knowledge acquired in the field of unmanned aerial vehicles. That was August 20th by a company called Israeli Aerospace Industry.
Well, one of the things about the Heron T that really sort of struck me was the fact that it is capable of actually carrying bombs, and it's capable of reaching where? Iran.
That's right.
Which is a very heavy thing on the world scene, you know, you think about that.
That's right. And, of course, Iran is now being targeted for the next attack, either by the U.S. or by Israel. American citizens are being given very filtered news coverage that makes a great many people think, you know, it's preparing people that if that happens, they'll think, well, you know, it had to be done. That's what's needed to make us safe. So that targeting, the same thing that was done with Iraq, leading people to think, well, they're weapons of mass destruction. We have to face the same kind of misleading reporting is being done about Iran right now. And weapons that can reach them are, they already, of course, have many weapons, but here's one more that will specifically be able to go from Israel to Iran.
You know, one thing I want to make sure I get this in, and we have just a few minutes left here, but I want to make sure we talk about this a little bit, which is, you know, some of the stuff that you're talking about when you talk about like these robo armies that are being developed by the Israeli military and the Israeli defense industry or aggression industry or attack industry or whatever you want to call it, which is would be much more truthful, really does remind you when they produce these things, they have been on the forefront of actually developing with the U.S., developing all kinds of nuclear, you know, weapons, all kinds of these drone type things and different types of mechanical robo warfare and all. And one of the things they recently did, and I saw this was included as a link in your article, and it was an article by Jonathan Cook from the Electronic Intifada about a game, not a game actually, it's not, when you first look at it, you think it's a game, it's called Spot and Shoot. Can you tell people what that is, Spot and Shoot, which really, really enraged me. It reminds you of District 9, that film about the apartheid in South Africa. It's really a very heavy development. Spot and Shoot, do you remember that?
That's right. That's where, again, it's people sitting at video monitors. Like you say, it looks like a video game. If anybody's read Orson Scott Card's books, they are very predictive of what's going on. So people, these women are sitting at videos looking like video games, and they are shooting people that come too near the border with Gaza. They have these, I read that article a while ago, I believe it's some type of weaponry. Machine guns or something. Some type of
automatic machine guns.
They're shooting. Yeah. They're shooting in cold blood. Random people that maybe came too close to what Israel. It's Palestinian territory. It's within Gaza, but they determine by their videos, that video, you know, game monitor, that somebody has come too close to what Israel has decided is a closed military zone, and they kill them in this spot and shoot technology. Not too long ago, just preceding the recent violence, they did that to a disabled teenager in Gaza. He was apparently, his parents say, mentally disabled boy. He wandered somewhere that what apparently Israel had determined no one was allowed to wander, and he was killed in cold blood. That happened just before this latest assault. And despite the fact that a teenager was killed, a 29-year-old was killed, there were Israeli shelling of Gaza. The L.A. Times called that a period of relative calm.
There you go. And that says it all. Okay, that's relative calm for U.S. imperialism. Allison, I want to ask you real quick to give a description of your website, if Americans knew, why you started it and what it does. We have about a minute.
Thank you. Thank you. It's ifamericansknew.org. I started it because I suddenly discovered this issue 10 years ago. I had never known anything about it. I traveled there as a freelance reporter by myself throughout Gaza and the West Bank. And when I came back, I thought Americans have to have the facts on this. We're paying for it. It is our $8 million a day to Israel that makes all of this possible. We need to know the facts. So on ifamericansknew.org, we give the statistics, we give the history, we give the latest and current news, and we are trying to provide the information that the U.S. media should be giving us, but they're not. So we're trying to do that. And we also have studies of the media showing. When I say that the media are not doing this, that's based on studies that document the omissions that they're doing.
All right, Allison, thank you very much. And it's ifamericansknew.org. I really recommend that people go and check that site out. It's just chock full of stuff that you won't get in the bourgeois press, quite frankly. Allison, thank you very much, and we'll talk to you again soon.
Thanks for having me.
Sure. Take care. All right. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host and producer, Michael Slate. Also, I want to thank my engineer today, Teddy Robinson, my production assistant, Henry Carson, and all of you for tuning in. You want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. We're going to go out now with We Won't Go Down Gaza by Michael Hart, so check it out.
They came with their tanks and their planes, with ravaging fiery flames, and nothing remains. Just a voice rising up in the smoky haze. We will not go down in the night without a fight. You can burn up our mosques and our homes and our schools, but our spirit will never die. We will not go down in Gaza tonight. Women and children alike, murdered and massacred night after night, while the so-called leaders of countries afar debated on who's wrong or right. But their powerless words were in vain, and the bombs fell down like acid rain. Through the tears and the blood and the pain, you could still hear that voice through the smoky haze. We will not go down in the night without a fight. You can burn up our mosques and our homes and our schools, but our spirit will never die. We will not go down.